Probably heard level three has been canceled, so we're not doing level three in November. We had a couple of people signed up, and we didn't have enough people committing. So, but we had, if we estimate, probably somewhere between 8 and 12 people did online training last month.
Good.
So we had, if there, it's a 250 level one, level two. If they did level three, that could have been just like six, seven people, something like that. But it's good. So you all are doing trainings, and some people are doing the online training. We have a couple more people on the verge of certification, so that's good. If you haven't gotten your certification documentation completed to me, if you're getting certified, be working on that. If I have to, we'll do the test Zoom wise. We'll do it Zoom, something like that. I prefer to do it face to face. But I prefer to have you work on me face to face if we can. But if there's a problem with that, then we just adapt accordingly. I'm not sure. So we'll be doing more. We just had a healing intensive for five, six people, so that went really well. So the small intensives, and I have people that are driving in to work with me intensively. So we have a setup. So if you need private training or individual work, there's an Airbnb for $50, a two-bedroom condo, very nice, next almost next door to me. That it's in the adjacent complex, apart from my condo complex. And for $50, you can stay there. And so I had a client that a chiropractor that just came in to work with me, and did 4 nights. I think we did like one, two, three, four, five, six sessions, something like that. And it worked out beautifully, worked out very well. Lots of food places around. Everybody can be socially distanced and secure and still do your trauma work. So people are coming in, working with me privately in the office that can drive in. They're still a little reluctant to fly in, but I was talking to some people. There have been very few cases of confirmed transmission by airplane. So for the millions of people that have flown, it's pretty minimal for airplane flights. Southwest is still creating a seat distance. So anyway, if you want to do, I also still do private training. So for a small group, the fee is a little higher, obviously. But if you have a couple of people that want to drive in, come in for a training, that's an option. Karen asked me for the research. Jeanette has the files now. Jeanette, you may still be around somewhere. All I got is a big J on my picture right now. But Jeanette has the PowerPoint research file. And Karen, I think you already had that, but I converted it to a PDF so we can transfer it to people if anybody's interested in the PowerPoint research part of this with the QEG results, some of the results. There's a lot of Karen, did you want me to upload all the QEGs that we did? Is that what you were asking about? Or just the PowerPoint version that we did? We need to
Just
un.
the PowerPoint.
Okay.
Just
Okay. So you have
the
that. You
PowerPoint
can
version.
forward it. You can. You're free. Feel free to send that to the people directly. That's probably the quickest
Okay.
way. Like, here's the
Yeah.
file.
Hey, Karen, you have
For
a
the
link
paper.
to that already. I have it up on a
Right.
Dropbox and you have a link.
But
it came up with the names of the clients rather than the numbers. When I
All right,
changed
I'll
that
check
to
what's out
Karen.
there.
Okay.
Okay for
I
the
think we
future.
have a first name and a last initial. But you know, the other thing is they have signed a release for all of their information for research purposes and so on. So it's
But just
publishable. But
for everybody else on the call, there is the entire data, all the QEE data is available, but it's available only through Jeanette, and you have to sign a waiver for confidentiality. But if okay.
anybody wants to see all the data, it's available.
Okay. Cool. Very good. So, questions, cases, things coming up for you this week, in the past week or two? We're a cozy little group this time. I had a client, I'll start with something. I had a client that came in who has had 25 facial surgeries. And she was born with a large purple growth on her lip and began doing surgeries for that. So the minute you say you have that many surgeries, what are one of the things we're going to do? Right away. Hi, Carrie. Yay, welcome.
Anesthesia.
Yeah, do the, what color do you move through your body to release the effects of anesthesia trauma?
and they'll see a color, and you do a waterfall for a couple of days. Actually, I recommend, just whenever you think about it, wash the anesthesia effects through the body. That's how they first found a lot of the effects of PTSD originally, is they discovered that after a person, what happened under anesthesia created a subconscious impulse. Like if the doctor is discussing pepperoni pizza during your surgery and you hate pepperoni pizza, you come out of surgery craving pepperoni pizza. Like, oh my God, it's time to play, you know, Bach or Beethoven or music during your surgical interventions, because the subconscious mind is hearing. It is awake. It is susceptible. It is programmable under anesthesia. So that is one piece. But also, just to clear the effects of the anesthesia, same thing for chemotherapy, is what colors do we move through our body to release the effects of chemo? What colors do you move through your body to release the effects of an election year? I'm just kidding, seeing if you're listening. Hello, we're still there. Post-traumatic election.
Colors?
PTED, post-traumatic election disorder. Oh no, okay. Reframe, breathe color, you're gonna be okay. You know, no matter who you vote for, you're gonna be all right. You know, all right, we'll survive. Everything's supposed to mellow out by March, so we'll see how it goes. So the 25 surgeries were interesting, because some of, you know, it's like when people said, what, when you worked with September the 11th, when you worked with TWA Flight 800, and that plane went down, what was that trauma? And I'm like, there isn't a September the 11th or a particular TWA Flight 800 trauma, or Oklahoma City bombing trauma. It's like, where were you? How did you see it? How did you find out about it? Who did you know that was involved in it? So trauma events are potential trigger mechanisms, but how it encoded in your body is absolutely relevant to your personal boundary formation. So the client with the 25 facial surgeries, the sad part is nowadays, if you're born with a little growth on, I forget what you call it, a growth on her lip, two surgeries and it's done. They correct it nowadays. But when she was born, and she's not that old, she's like in her 30s, they just started surgery after surgery after surgery to try to correct it. And she's been through 25. The interesting part is she definitely has body dysmorphia. So she's like, oh, my face is so deformed and everybody can see my surgery and where it happened. And her husband, who married her not long ago, I was like, have you ever seen anything or noticed anything? He's like, I really don't. The surgery, plastic surgery, was excellent. The last surgeries covered everything up. And I said, can you remove your mask for me? Because we're still wearing masks at Miraval, whatever. Things are picking up there too, by the way. But I said, can you remove your mask so I can just see if there's any objective evidence that we're talking about? And I'm like, where on your lip was this thing originally? I said, there's no trace of anything. But apparently when they did the facial surgeries in those days, they didn't have the technology and the filler kinds of things they have now. So every 3 months she has to go in to have a filler injection, or there's a slight collapse in the lip or something like that, and it becomes a little more visible. But in her current state, I'm like, no, nobody out here knows there's anything going on with your lip whatsoever. You look amazing and beautiful. And, you know, I said, there's no visible evidence of anything. She says, I know, but there were times when I came out of anesthesia as a child and there was nobody there and nobody to comfort me. And I was having pain, a lot of pain in my lip. And my mouth was taped shut with the tube and I couldn't say anything and there was nobody there. So it created almost like a panic attack reaction to the anesthesia. I had 5 people this past week say I have panic attacks. When did you have a panic attack? Well, when I was in New Orleans at Mardi Gras and they put a boa constrictor around my neck. I'm like, that's not a panic attack. That's like PTSD from attack from a boa constrictor. I was like, you know, that's not an anxiety attack. I was like, you're being traumatized. I said, that's a normal reaction to having a boa constrictor put her. And she had a fear of snakes. And I'm like, you know, if somebody puts a boa constrictor around my neck, I'm going to need therapy, but I'm not going to need a Xanax or a Valium. I'm going to need actually to reframe the boa constrictor. So I'm like, you have a fear of snakes? She says, yeah. So let's get rid of the boa constrictor to begin with. So we reframe that. But I'm like, so I have people coming with all these phobias. Oh yeah, I have panic attacks because I had this horrible thing happen. I was like, when did it happen? Oh, well, I found out my parents were divorcing and then my brother was sick and I wasn't feeling well. I said, that's probably, it could be built up towards a panic attack. But I said, when you have that many stressors coming at you all at once, you're having a PTSD and anxiety reaction from overwhelm. And I said, panic attacks typically kind of come out of the blue and hit people when they're just driving a car or they're driving up to McDonald's and nothing's happening, they're having a nice day, and suddenly they can't breathe. And I said, panic attacks most typically, you know, seem to occur when there's not an obvious stimulus. I said, you're having an actual traumatic reaction to a threat, a perceived threat. And so I was like, we need to just reframe the original threat. And I'm not kidding, 75 to 85% of panic attacks I've ever worked on go away with the reframe of the original event. So I don't know how many panic attacks are really this kind of uncontrollable, out of the blue, unexpected trigger mechanism activation, or how much is actually there's a legitimate traumatic threat. So when somebody says they have anxiety, ask if you remember the first time what was happening, typically what was happening the day the first one occurred. And for all five cases I worked with, we found the originating event, reframed it. I'm like, how do you feel now? She's like, well, I don't feel any anxiety. One of the persons I worked on was put into Sierra Tucson where they proceeded to admit her for emotional issues, and they do a strip search on you for anxiety, for drugs. And of course, she's now freaking out like, oh my God, what are they doing to me? And she basically left after a day, crossed the street, came over to Mirabal. And then I began working with her, and she did really, really well. We referred her like three or four of the alternative therapists, healers. Tesh Paul does Brennan energy work. Another person does breath work, trauma work, and we did the breath work with her. I worked on her twice and reframed probably 6 to 7 major traumatic memories. And there's alcoholism in the family. So when she was younger, she drank too much and some bad things happened. So we reframed the drinking related traumas that were compiled. Mother's bipolar, unpredictable. Dad was completely abandoning. So when we have these things, I'm like, wow, these people have tremendous trauma by their teens. And then she's acting out her stuff. So we reframed the acting out, but traumas that she had, drank too much, passed out, bad things happened when she passed out, got abused. So we need to reframe that and shame about that. But a lot of her anxiety turned out to be legitimate stressors from her family. And when we reframed having a bipolar, unpredictable mother and the behaviors that came with that, level ones and level twos, she calmed down immediately. And by the time she came in for a second session, I'm like, it's not even the same girl that fled Sierra Tucson. She's very calm. She's relaxed. She's breathing colors. She was actually she's 20. So up to 21, understand, 0 to 7, excellent. 7 to 14, really, really great creative kids. 14 to 21, it gets a little bit more challenging sometimes. 21 to 28, I don't know what it is. Every 7-year cycle, we get a little denser. And that's not to mean to insult you or your clients. It's just through reinforcement and cell replication, our fields seem to become a little more congested and it becomes a little more challenging to access memory. But up to 21, these are great clients. And she's like 20 and she saw every single color she picked is on my list of colors for exactly what she used it for. Precisely. I mean, she's like, pink, taking back my power as a woman. You know, guys are shaming me and putting me down. I'm using pink. I'm taking my power back. You know, I need to get rid of this anxiety. I'm going to use my aquamarine blue. It's like, yeah, blues and greens. Anxiety. I feel so nervous and anxious. Oh my God, I need yellow. I need yellow sunlight. I was like, well, there it is, yellow for the nervous system. So while I don't suggest you deify the list that I gave you about colors, the fact is that's an additional successful reinforcement tool that you're going to have, you know, that helps to build in confidence for the client. When they can read about it, say, oh, wow, he's right. Look, I use color at the end, you know, for reframing my anxiety and my tension in my body. Yellow is there. I said, yeah, yellow heals nerve damage, nerve pain. And for the girl with the lip issue, I was like, with all this pain, I said, I want you, you know, she saw yellow, but I said, I want you running that yellow through your lip for a while for the next few days. She definitely had lip dysmorphia, though. She's like, my face is disfigured, I'm deformed. And I said, well, how many memories, how many traumas and surgeries have you had? So my question I'm really asking is, how many trances are you still in where your lip is in pain? How many trances are you in where your lip is still feeling disfigured? And she's like, well, I don't know if I've ever reframed the surgeries. I'm like, okay. Well, you have 25 reinforced memories with your lip is big, it's swollen, it feels like it still has the purple thing. I said, you're not even reacting to your lip as it's real anymore. You have 25 reinforced traumas at the same site. And I said, you're feeling like your face is deformed. I said, your face is not deformed. You're beautiful. But I said, you have, and you're, I explained the 5% conscious, which knows your lip is fine. And the 95% subconscious was like, oh my God, there's swollen lip. My, it's cut. It's purple. It's, you know, deformed. And oh, the mother and father, when she was born, she was like the fourth child, first girl. They're like, oh my God, you know, there's something wrong with her face. They wouldn't take her out in public. She had a feeling that her mother didn't like to look at her, that it reminded her that she did something wrong or something like that. So she was taking shame in here as an infant, like something's really wrong, I'm defective. And even though it's completely corrected, you would not know it. She doesn't, the minute you start talking about her face or her lips, she starts crying, tearful. And this is a beautiful girl who just got married, and the husband has never seen her with any lip deformity, nothing. Nothing, it was all surgically corrected. 98% was corrected 10 years ago. And she now has a little bit of surgery to do better fillers and things in her lip. But to look at her, I don't know where it even occurred. Of course, with COVID there, I couldn't get close enough to find out either. So we're still working across the room. But the 25 things, so with people with repeated surgeries, and it was a really good example of body dysmorphia issues, that if there's trauma, and you have pain and you have hurt, and even when the pain is gone, if the memory is still intact and nobody's taken you out of the post-surgical swelling, pain condition, acute pain, I need it. And I tried to talk her into that. I said, you're going back to New York. I said, but you really maybe want to follow up with Melanie in New York. So I'm referring you all people, by the way, when they go home. Miraval is getting people, so I'm seeing about 7-8 clients a week there. We're still socially distancing. We're doing everything in masks, and it's fine. But I said, you want to reframe all of that? And I hope she heard me, that she understood what I was saying, because I'm telling you, folks, this is what's happening with these medical traumas. At the time the surgery takes place and the pain occurs, the body's capturing a memory of that pain or of that illness. And along with the actual recovery from the condition, the medical recovery, we have to reframe the trance states. So HMR needs to be accompanying medical surgeries and things and coming out of anesthesia. And at the end of a surgery, I think the time will come, we say, is there anything we need to reframe before you leave the hospital? Is there anything we need to reframe after your medical treatment here that was done improperly or that you feel overwhelmed you? This would be proper medical care, including the emotional psychological feature. Is there anything we can do to make sure that was your stay good? So it's not quality assurance. This is like mental stability prior to departure. Like, is there anything traumatic or stressful that happened that we could reframe with you to make sure that your body is in an optimal and functioning state, that your adrenals are not active and your T cells are, you know, fully functioning? Because if we traumatize you as we're treating you during your surgery, we've compromised the effort at fixing, you know, doing the surgery and our medical intervention. So, I mean, the time will come. Some of you know I did a lecture for 80 surgeons in Reno, Nevada one year, and I was like, you know, how you deliver information can traumatize your client. How the procedure is done can traumatize your client. And one of the guys said, oh yeah, we know all about that. I said, what do you know? He's like, we know we have to be nice to the client, because if the surgery goes bad, they're less likely to sue us if we've made friends and are talking nicely to them. I'm like, that's not what I'm talking about. That's not the same thing. I'm not talking about avoiding legalities. I'm like, along with the medical painful procedures, they always tell you how painful something is going to be. And when it shocks you, the body takes a picture and captures the pain. Her lip has 25 surgical memories in her lip, I could tell. And what she was talking about, oh yeah, you know, it feels sometimes here and it moves around and it feels swollen and it feels distorted. I'm like, you're not living. You're in phantom pain from your 25 surgeries. So I hope she calls and does follow up with that, but I'm not sure she fully understood. But I said, I'll give you the explanation about why you're not seeing your face as it is. I said, by the way, your face is lovely. And she kind of smiled, like, yeah, I kind of look in the mirror and can kind of get that. There are moments when I get that. But she has like 5% awareness that her face is fine. And 95% of the time, I think she's running around feeling like there's still distortion. How much of that, I wonder, transfers over to our clients that have been through eating disorder treatment, other kinds of treatments where they were. And in the old days of chemical dependency treatment, they shamed you to try to make you admit you were alcoholic. So I don't know how much of that sometimes reinforced shame or addictive patterns and help to perpetuate the problem. So anyway, that was an interesting case, 25 medical surgeries. I'm like, you know, we might want to do a few sessions about that. I had one 80 minute, actually it was less than, well, it was about 80 minutes. She and her husband wanted to do joint sessions. He wanted to sit in. And I worked on him about 30 minutes and I worked on her about 90 to 100 minutes. And she's like, I'm so sorry, I'm taking all the time. He's like, no, that's fine. And really, he didn't have a huge amount of acute trauma, whereas compared to her, she saw that she needed the time. So I like when couples do sessions together. I said, also, you need to really affirm for her. I said, plus, as a side effect, it must be very disturbing for you as the husband to want to kiss your wife and be intimate or be close and to realize that she can't go, she's not there. She's in a state of distress about her face. When she feels bad about herself, she needs the affirmation, say, you know, you're beautiful, you're wonderful. Affirm that for her. I said, 52 repetitions, it goes into her subconscious. I said, but it must be very challenging when she's not seeing herself as you see her. She's not seeing her goodness, her beauty, and can really appreciate how attractive she is to you. The shame will not let that in. Shame is a primary affect. It blocks out the ability of the partner to compliment her and for her to receive it. Gershon Kaufman talked about that. Shame is a primary affect. Trauma is a primary affect. He can say you're beautiful. And I said, you know, this must be playing out in your relationship a little bit. He says you're lovely, you're beautiful, I love you so much. And you're like, yeah, nice, thank you. But my lip is like, I feel like I'm deformed. So that's very sad when you think about how trauma captures the subconscious and limits the capacity for intimacy or communication. You know, she's in a dysmorphic facial state and not seeing how she really was very beautiful, very lovely. I said, and you, I never know you had anything whatsoever. There's no purple, weird thing, deformity left. She says, yeah, but I know what I've been through. I said, not only do you know what you've been through, you're still living through it. I said, parts of you are still lying on an operating table and you're in post-surgical care. Nobody's ever, and that's the scandal of this. Nobody's ever taken her out. She has so much medical trauma. Nobody has ever taken her out of the post-surgical care trance state. Nobody's ever taken her out of the room when she woke up and nobody was there and her lips were taped shut and she's alone in pain. You know, horrible. And that's one surgery, one surgical event, post-surgical event. So anyway, these are the things that gets very complex. And of course, the more you practice, the more trained you are, the more complex clients you're going to see. I'll do my best to share those with you as they come up. But that's one example of just the body dysmorphic from repeated medical intervention. And it was just, you know, it was a little thing she was born with as an infant. So it began before she was even very conscious. But I find the most powerful trances, the younger you are, the stronger the distortion, the stronger the trance state, I should say. So that's a very, to have it treated like you're weird and people avoiding you. And then by the time she got to school, she was made fun of, what's wrong with you? So there's other trauma from teen kids and people that were cruel to her. So there's a lot of trauma outside the 25 surgeries, you know? So anyway, that's the kind of complexity sometimes we'll be facing with these reframes. My protocol would be let's slowly over time work through all the surgicals, the memories, whatever once present in her body and the order they present is probably how I would go. But there are times with PTSD with vets as I just take down the sequencing, first surgery, give me the years of the surgeries, give me the years of the interventions on your face or your body, and let's reframe all of those surgeries, all of those interventions. And the body will catch anything that you miss. Inevitably, the body will bring up, oh, I forgot this happened right after that surgery. I had another little car accident and it weakened my throat or my jaw where I had had the injury. Well, let's reframe that as well. So anyway, that was an interesting case over the past few weeks. Any questions or other cases you'd like to present, Bill?
I had a question about so I had a client recently who would not allow much compassion for herself, you know, and we discovered something for herself and she just wasn't open to, she couldn't also have trouble being compassionate for herself. Would that be shame likely too?
That is, but the first thing that comes to my mind is whose voice is that?
Okay.
Who's taken over her management function? That's that critical. Because when they're using their own the self, the manager self-management self-talk style is hypercritical. They've internalized a critical series of memories, and usually they've modeled after a hypercritical parent, perfectionist. So okay. I would ask, I'd go back to the history. Do you have a hypercritical? You know, I had one client. She was DID. I'm trying to reframe with her, and she's seeing her little wounded inner child, and she's sobbing and crying. I said, what would you like to do for her if you could go in and help her as the adult self? She's like, kill her. I was like, okay. I said, whose voice is that? Whose voice is that? I mentioned this before. Whose voice is that? Oh, that's my dad. He hated children. So that's your most extreme example. So when the critic comes up, I'm like, where did this come from? And sometimes they'll say, my parents, I don't think my parents are very critical. I learned to be perfectionistic myself, though. And then you'll have to see where that evolved within the history. But yeah, I would go to, if she's like, no compassion for me. Oh, children learn. I mean, children are very, they're fun. They're spontaneous. They're playful. They don't think like, I'm evil, I'm bad, I don't deserve love or compassion, I'm unworthy. But yes, you're describing definitely a side effect of some kind of shaming, damage to the self-esteem, no attachment, no bonding. Something's wrong with that picture, and you need to find out where that came from. So I would back up to the parents and find the history.
So, Brent, when you are working with that complex issue as far as the number of surgeries over a period of time, do you on your intake and in your history for that particular person, do you write down those dates and then go back to those dates, or do you just wait for them to come up as they come up?
You know, I don't think I've ever had 25 like that surgeries in a row. I'd have to think about that. And I'm not sure that all, sometimes when you've had that many surgeries, they start blurring together. So they become a level two. So I might just go to her body, but I think because they're so invasive and they're reinforcing each other, I might make a list of them and see if we need, and when she gets vague and like, I don't really remember that one anymore, it's not really there, I don't think we'd have to work on that one. We might end up doing a level two, like all the surgeries. What was common to like 8 or 10 of the surgeries? Oh, I just go in, they knock me out, and I come to, and I have to wait, and it takes a long time for it to heal. So I might do a level two and then go to the body and see which individual memories are left, which surgeries are still there. So my tendency is always to try to let the client map it for themselves. When it comes to the vets, though, in the sequencing, sometimes the vets don't realize. One of the traumas is, you know, like she's not going to remember her, all likely she doesn't remember her birth with a lip. She didn't see it. She doesn't perceive it. She doesn't know anything's wrong. It's like our first research subject that we did. She was a forceps delivery, and she fell off the changing table as an infant or rolled off. And so all four memories in our first research study, one of the four memories of our research subject, one of the four primary memories she had knowledge of. The other three memories in our research subject, she had no conscious memory of. So we just asked, okay, if you could imagine like being born, coming into the world, being born to your mommy, if we could picture a very lovely birth, smooth delivery. So we reframed her forceps delivery. We reframed. She didn't remember falling off the changing table, and she had a concussion, so it probably erased the memory anyway. A sufficient enough impact or blow to the head, and the little neurotransmission thing was never completed. There is no memory imprinted, but the body remembers the blow site. The impact site is available to an empath or energy worker. She'll see it. They'll feel it. And I was like, okay. Like I was working on a woman client today, the one that came in and worried me. And we're nearing the end of the process. We think we're almost done. And suddenly I have a pain in my left jaw. And I'm like, we were working on her dental surgeries on the right. And then I had a sharp pain in my left jaw. And I'm like, oh, I said, let me scan your face. Can I scan your face for a second? She said, sure. And I'm scanning and I'm like, wham, it hits my hand. And I'm like, an impact to my hand is usually an impact to the face. So I was like, have you ever had an impact to your face? She's like, oh my God. She said, we worked on all the boyfriends and the ex-husbands, but we didn't work on my first boyfriend. And she said, I was with him for 6 years, and I remember when he forehanded me across the face. And as she said that, I got needles and pain. And I'm like, it was a really forceful blow to her face. It was not a happy moment.
And I'm like, and I'm just telling you this because those of you that are empaths, the longer you practice this and the clearer you get, you're going to get their face impact. You're going to feel it in your face. It doesn't hurt me. It passes through. And I'm like, oh, that's what it is. And then you get, that's what it is. It's gone. They're just letting you feel like the mirror, you're mirroring the echo of that memory in their body, and you're giving permission to mirror so I can ask the question. So I felt it, and I'm like, what in the world? I said, what happened here? Let me think, was he right-handed? Oh yeah, he was right-handed, and he swung across and he hit me on the right side of my face. And the minute she reframed it and didn't date him or got rid of him, the pain was gone. So pain, my pain was gone, her pain was gone. Everybody was like clear. So back to our questions here about the physical side. I prefer to have the client bring it up. I might do a level two. If we could release all the shame from all, I might, you know, when you have that many and they tell you, technically, if we were doing absolutely strict, I had one of my clients that took an exam years ago, and she's like, if you were doing absolutely strict client-centered therapy, you'd only work on the memories the client brings up. I said, but, she said, but, when you see them suffering, I'm like, how old are you when you feel that? I'm five, he's incesting me. How old are you when you're feeling that? Five, and he's incesting me. How old are you when you feel that? Five and a half, and he's incesting me. Like, we could go at this forever. So I'm like, okay, if we could take all the little girls that were incested by him and take them to your safe place, how many are there? 536 of them. I'm like, okay, let's get those safe. And then the memories that are left that remain, we'll work on individually. So it's possible with the 25 surgeries, I'll bet over the years, especially as a young child, not remembering a whole lot of being put under anesthesia, I'll bet some of them blurred together. So I don't think we probably have to go memory by memory. But, you know, when that particular, when the one, like when she came to and her mouth was taped shut and there was nobody there and she's in pain and she panicked when nobody was there, no eye contact, nobody when she came to. That was a specific memory. So what I tell people generally is that the level two will take out the pattern collective that blurred together. It'll release the body. But that doesn't mean there aren't still individual level one memories and even some level twos of a slightly different theme that might still be present and require a reframing. So the level twos, they may be coming. Mostly it's level individual scenes. That was really bad when she came out and nobody was there. And then sometimes the pain is really acute after the surgery or the anesthesia. They say it's not supposed to happen. Anesthesia, anesthesiologist will tell you, you can't come to and, you know, be conscious during your surgery. And I've had three cases where they absolutely came to in the middle of a heart surgery or something else, and the anesthesia wore off and they're like, oh my God, you know, they're cutting on me and I can't move, I can't talk, I can't make eye contact or anything to let them know that I'm awake and feeling this. You know, so it does happen. And that's the kind of thing we would need to reframe. And then I have some anesthesiologists say, we know that really does happen. We're not supposed to, you know, admit very much about that. So, so you have choices. You'll have to use your own intuition about that. Like, do I know, see, like with the fireman that was like, his jaw is knocked out. Well, he's knocked unconscious. He doesn't remember, have any memory of the thing hitting him. But that's such a violent impact. When you have a violent impact to the body and they go unconscious, always reframe that moment. Reframe that event. Even if you say, imagine it, make it up, pretend. I want to access it in your body. Now, you and I, if you're an empath, you can scan like, oh, well, here it is right here. I said, do you feel that? And I put energy into it. Yeah, it's tightening. It feels achy. So she felt, the minute I said that, she felt her face slap. She's like, oh, I forgot about Ray, you know, hitting me in the face. I'm like, okay, let's get his handprint off your face. So you can put energy into the site so it goes active, or you can say, imagine it. And that's enough. Most of the time, that's enough to access it. And you can tell, like for the little girl, we did our first research subject when I reframed the forceps, because I thought forceps delivery, a lot of times that's a concussion or head trauma. Then she fell off the changing table, though the emergency room said she was fine. She wasn't, you know. And then she had her first seizure 7 years after her birth, 7 year cycle. So on around the seventh birthday, she had her first seizure. And then I saw her actually on her eighth birthday, which I thought was kind of interesting. But I saw her on her eighth birthday, did the technique. And for the next few months, I know she had no seizures. I think they moved, and we don't know what the follow-up on that was. It's possible she went back to school and there were a few other kinds of memories we missed. Something could come back. But at least for the next few months, the fact that her seizures were like 2-3 times a week, and they went down to zero immediately,
means that we're on the right track. We're overlaying and putting in a, if it's a memory-based relive of a trauma, we're creating a corrective overlay over that memory engram or imprint. And as long as you don't take a benzodiazepine, it should hold, you know. I had a client who started, we mentioned this in the past, those of you that weren't there. I had a client that was prescribed benzos a year after I worked on her. She had stopped having seizures. When she had a stressful event, they gave her benzodiazepines and her seizures started coming back. And I'm like, ugh, they're giving her benzos to repress her memories. They're repressing her memory of HMR. They're repressing the memory of HMR. They're repressing the corrective overlay. And she's having the seizures again. So I'm like, you got to get off the benzos. So then I sent them to Mary Gatti. And Mary's like, here's your protocol for the next 6 to 9 months to detox you from the benzodiazepine safely. Make sure you're off benzos and don't take that group of drugs. But yeah, so as far as the surgeries go, I would want to take down, give me a list. Can you make a list for me of your surgeries, what yours, what they were about, a little description of each one. Wanting to be kind of perfectionistic and thorough, I probably, as a precaution, if I really want all of her body dysmorphia to clear, I'd probably reframe all of the surgical memories if I could. I think that would be advisable. At 25, I only had one other guy at 23 memories in his right shoulder blade. And it was just, once you're traumatized, you know, I've come up with a list of how many principles. I'll probably do a talk about that sometime soon. But it's most of it I've incorporated into the level 3 manual now. It's in the level 3 section. But 14 principles about energy transactions that I've observed from trauma imprinting. And one of them is the primary attraction site, that once you're like betrayed by your brother in your right shoulder blade, or even if he did the left shoulder blade, all betrayal memories from anybody, corporate or otherwise, political, are going to go to your right shoulder blade. It's kind of like a magnetic theme attraction. So all the themes will go, even if it's male or female, it'll go to the right shoulder blade because that's where the first one occurred. So I had one young man, he had 20, you feel that? Where do you feel that? You think you're going to go crazy as a therapist, right? When you feel that, where do you feel that? My right shoulder blade, inside or outside? It's still inside. But then sometimes it'll move out a little bit or on the surface. It's a triangle, now it's a rectangle, now it's a ball, now it's back to being a line, now it's a trapezoid. When you'll get used to the geometric forms of the metaphors. And finally, on the 23rd, that's my shoulder blade, finally got to the 23rd, like, any pain left there? He's like, no. Now it's in my rotator cuff. I was like, ready to applaud, celebrate. Yay, finally. We get to move to a different site in your body. But we can't have ego attached. There's no room for ego. I'm sure we're all gonna have a client where there's 50 memories at the same site. And on the 51st memory, the pain will finally leave and go away. So I don't control the layering or the encoding or the repetition, but 25 surgeries on your lip. I'm like, oh, on that one little spot, I was like, oh my goodness. We have some work to do. So she did not, the interesting part was she had body dysmorphia only for here, only for her face. It was not for anything else in her body. She's beautiful, never had weight problems, anything. It was just all focused right here. So that's very interesting because people born with, you know, any kind of a deformity or some kind of a birthmark, you know, they're gonna have to go through these kinds of surgeries or treatments. In the old days, some of them were very traumatic. So that was interesting. I never had lip face dysmorphia like that before, but it makes total sense. We're gonna have multiple surgeries at certain sites in the body where the body is initially injured or that emotional theme occurs, like betrayal by your dad in your teenage years, he got drunk and incested you. Watch the right knee. Watch the mid-thoracic area in the back for the breach and support. Check the pelvic region, especially on the male side. Watch that right hip, power transfer in the right hip. Is he transferring power? Did he use that to abuse you? You know, take advantage. So anyway, the shame thing is interesting. I had a client that I worked on recently who, at 4, the father died violently. I won't go into detail, but the father died violently. When there is no parent,
the uncle, some of the sexually addicted uncles. By the time a child has no parent and they're not protected, most of you probably know this, but pedophiles will target children that have no parental protection, that have no noticeable protector. And so this little girl's dad was dead, and this is a relative, an uncle. It's like, okay, her dad's dead. And her mom in these, we'll say it's a Hispanic family, there's a big umbrella about take care of your own and keep secrets. You know, don't share shameful, embarrassing things about your family or your own. And so the uncle locks the door and at six, you know, does something sexual with her. And there's shame and she can't escape. So she has to go along with it or he won't unbolt the door, which she can't reach and escape. Finally, by the time she's 12, she tells the mother, who's like, who did you tell? Who did you tell about this? Because it's all about secrecy and don't let anybody know. Don't tell grandma. If you tell your father, he's going to murder your uncle. You know he's going to kill him. And like, oh my God, I can't be responsible for the death of my uncle. So this little girl gets no protection, no response from the mother, you know, all over again. And so she's not safe from men. She's not safe from the women. She's not safe from anybody. And this stays in her body. So she had, you asked about shame and your client, Bill, you know, right off the bat after the abuse at six, she's like, I'm such a bad girl. I did such horrible things. And I'm like, wait a minute. I said, you know, you don't know right from wrong, hit moral development until 7 or 8. I was like, this is not about you. So, you know, I walk them through the 5 stages of self-esteem imprinting or shame imprinting. You know, children are not born with shame. It comes from outside of you. Through repetition, it's internalized. Through repetition, it becomes autonomous, self-ruling, automatic on its own. It doesn't require external after a certain point. If you keep living with it inside your computer, which was the only place you could contain the shame, you get so used to living with it, you identify with it. I am the shame. I am defective. There's something wrong with me. And then the smallest little thing that goes wrong, you think echoes or mirrors the fact that there is something majorly wrong. And so the holographic spiral triggers the shame that's already there. And now you're completely convinced that you're defective and shameful and don't deserve to live, you know, or be loved. Same 5 stages of self-esteem. Oh, you're so cute. You're so adorable. Oh, who's that lady? She seems nice. Maybe she's okay. You know, yeah, you are a beautiful little adorable baby. Okay, maybe I am pretty, or maybe there's something right with me. And then like over time, yeah, I think I am a pretty good person. Adolescence, I'm a pretty good person. I think I'm okay. And then if it keeps being reinforced, yeah, I have a lot of good things about me. People love me. I love other people. I feel good about myself. So the identity is positive. And then the smallest compliment, you know, like, you look so good in that purple shirt, Jeanette. Oh, thank you. I know I look good in indigo violet or purple, whatever. Like, thank you. So my indigo violet, yeah. So thank you. I feel good about that. I know I look good in purple, so different. So the same 5 stages can imprint positively or negatively. You're just trying to gauge how early, how soon did the client get the negative shame imprinting. And one single act can give you a terrible message. I think when she told the uncle, when she was trapped by the uncle and then felt like she couldn't talk about it, and he did threaten her. He says, I will kill your family. I will harm you and I will harm your family and no one will believe you if you tell them anyway. And so he absolutely threatened her. And so it took her 6 years until she was 12 years old and living in the US before she could finally get up the courage to tell her mother what her uncle had done. And her mother's response, who did you tell about this? Because the mother's husband's dead. The only support she has is from her family. And she doesn't want to alienate the extended family because that's where she gets her resources to survive. She's dependent on that very same family and doesn't want the shame of the secret to get out. So there it is. So that's where we got all that coming from. So anyway, that's a little bit about the complex layering, you know, between the incest that sets it up, the shame imprinting. But, you know, we had to separate out the guilt from the shame. There's a lot. With your clients, you're going to have a lot of that kind of re-education process or going through the paradigm shift from psychologically thinking of moral judgment, moral failure as our way of assessing events to how much willpower did you have, or how much trauma did you have prior to your decision making that would have compromised your willpower. The old model was in the 50s, you know, 100% just say no. It's all conscious willpower. Well, since the 50s till now, 70 years, what's happened is your conscious mind's dropped from 100% to 5%, and your unsub has gone up to 95%. And so HMR targets the 95%. To the extent that you were abused, frozen, paralyzed, made to feel powerless, indecisive, unable to move or go forward in time, your ability to make volition work for you is going to be impaired to the extent that you're frozen in the 95%. We are quantum creators, but to the extent that there's abuse or trauma in the unconscious, in the subconscious, your 5% intention is only going to be as successful as the permissions allow the energy movement through your unsub. So if you were molested and made to feel shameful at 5, pre-moral, pre-conscious, I might tell you you're a beautiful little girl, you're lovely, and by the time you're in grade school, you don't feel that way, you don't believe me. It's not imprinting. You've already gotten shamed. John Bradshaw in his work said we have shame by the age of 2. Trauma precedes morality for nearly all of us. To the extent that you were majorly shamed as a child, your ability to follow moral precepts is proportionately compromised. So I have an Asperger's father. I'm in school and they're like, he's very shy. He doesn't talk very much. Biggest complaint in high school as a senior, as the valedictorian, it would be nice if he talked. It'd be nice if he spoke sometimes. So I was like the silent valedictorian. In fact, I almost tried to get out of being valedictorian because I had to give a speech. I'm like, oh my God, I have to talk in public. I'm going to die. This isn't going to work. So anyway, the shame you have as a child, you imitate an Asperger's father, your volition, like, oh, you have to talk, you have to speak up in class. Yeah, like that's going to happen. That's not going to happen for a shy, introverted child of an Asperger's parent. It's not even possible. I'm like, oh my God, how far can I climb under the desk so I don't have to answer a question in class? I remember the anxiety about being called on. Like, oh no, we don't do attention from people. We'd rather be invisible. So to the extent that you have a traumatic family, traumatic parents, if you have shame as a child, I just internalized the shame-like behaviors of my Asperger's father, who didn't look comfortable in social settings, seemed very fearful, anxious. So I internalized that fear. So to that extent, your morality, your 5% moral, conscious, rational mind is conditioned by the flow of energy in your 95%. And if you're very abused, molested, made to feel shame, I can compliment you and you're like, yeah, what's he after? What does he want from me? I don't believe that's true. I told this girl she's beautiful. I'm sure she brushed it off. She doesn't feel that way. Trauma is a feeling distortion, a feeling impression. Your rational 5% mind might know that she survived and that people think she looks okay, but it made no difference to her. And poor husband, I'm like, she's beautiful and she can't enjoy it. She can't enjoy that her face is so pretty. She's still in 25 surgical distortions. What the heck are we gonna do with this? So I said, here's what we would do. It's not complicated. I said, I'm a matrix thinker. I see the patterns. I see what happened. I said, you really are lovely. And I said, the good news is your 5% is correct. And he'll tell you, I'll tell you, well, I'll tell you, you're lovely. I said, I'm not hitting you on you, I'm gay, so stay calm, you know, you're all right. You know, sometimes I tell my clients that I'm not hitting on you, I have good taste. You know, you're very pretty, but you need to know that if you're not feeling that way and not experiencing, seeing that, I'm like, okay, then where is that distortion coming from? Where's that distortion coming from for you? And like 25 surgeries will do it. I mean, one or two surgeries like that, with that lock in. If it's locked in, so a trauma is a moment, you know, we lock in with that distorted false perception. And in 95% of our mind, it's life or death, and it's being protected. It's being maintained. Unless we correct that, it's gonna be a problem. Anyway, just some relevant thoughts about that. Some of you join us earlier, later for supervision, but the stages of shame, and I use shame as the emotion word for trauma. Gershon Kaufman defined shame as an alienation of the self from self. What is that? That's a dissociation. That's the emotional description of a dissociation. So, you know, is the Glenda okay? Is Glenda not okay? Is Carrie okay? Is Carrie not okay? You know, is Karen okay? Is she not okay? You know, energy is lost every time we split or dissociate. Every time we shame, there's an energy loss to the system, and we're trapped in a moment of powerlessness. So anyway, so about your shame things, so I would suggest you try to, I try to evaluate the client, like, how deep is the shame imprinting? Where did this come from? And she's like, oh, well, I was born with this. The other client came from the abuse, a death of dad at 4, murder of dad at 4, actually, and then the sexual abuse at 6. So anyway, that's a little bit about that. Other questions or comments or thoughts about that?
Brent, I have a comment, and this is completely off the topic that you're talking about, but I in part of my mentoring work with students here in Houston, I attended a conference for human trafficking, because you would not believe what young kids are seeing and being exposed to. And in that conference, there was a guy who actually works with some of these recovering traffickers, sexual abuse people. And he told me, told all of us, he said, I am going to tell you as an interested party, adult, as an adult, something that you can do that is so simple that can often prevent a human traffic incident happening if you are out in the public. And that is that if you see a young 12 to 18 year old child sitting by themselves, waiting for a bus, waiting for something, walk over, stand within 5-6 feet of them, pull out your cell phone and just, you know, touch your, you know, work on your cell phone, glance over and say hello or something like that. You know, they may not even answer you. If a trafficker is in the area, they do not know if that adult is watching that child, and they will pass that child by as opposed to stop to talk to them. The other thing they told us is if you walk up, if you happen to be walking around and you see some kid by themselves and somebody's talking to them, and you get that kind of, something doesn't feel right in your stomach, just walk over, stand within about 5 feet, pull your cell phone out, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Look up and say hello to whoever's the adult is that's talking to that kid. Just say good day and just stand there on your cell phone. 9 times out of 10, they will leave. And I never thought about how simple a thing that was to do that might ensure safety for young people who are out there, do not realize that they are being affected, or as you put it, they're unprotected by an adult and they are being zeroed in by an adult to possibly harm them in some way. So I've been meaning to pass that on to the group, because I thought, what a simple thing. I mean, if you're standing around, stand around on your phone, you know? So I just thought it was a good piece of information that was given to me. So I wanted to share it with everybody.
Cool. Well, thanks. Yeah, that's good protection. That's good to know.
Now, it's hard to...
There may be other ways to use that too, so.
Yeah. Yeah, you can do it for anybody. I mean, evidently, human traffickers need seclusion and secrecy to do what they want to try to do often. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that there is another pair of eyes watching will often scare them away, you know. So anyway, that's just something I thought I would. I've been meaning to say it to the group, and I keep forgetting every time. So I
thanks.
Think.
Well, that's good. Extend your boundary awareness. Like, okay, something feels not right or unsafe. That could be very helpful. Show that you're aware somebody's nearby. Yeah, that reminds me of something, but I can't think of what it is. There's another boundary circumstance where that could be used. Maybe call it. Okay. Other questions? Cases?
I've got one. You mentioned phobias very, very briefly earlier. And I have a client who has a very intense fear of cicadas, and she has no idea where it came from. And the next session we meet, we want to try to work on that. And I'm wondering, how do I actually get to it? If she doesn't know where the experience originated from, do I just have her think about cicadas until she has a feeling of fear and just, you know, where is it at in the body and go from there? Or is there something else I'm supposed to be doing?
I think that's probably the easiest way to get to it is, when you think about that, where do you feel that fear? And see what comes up. You might be surprised. Sometimes there's actually, I'm not sure, do you feel it in your body anywhere? Where do you feel yourself tensing up? And it might not be about that. It could be about something on a cartoon or a TV show that looked like that, where it reminds them of a noise or something they heard. It isn't always what it looks like, but it could be like with
For the Asperger's type kids, it could be a feeling, a sensation, a sound from something else that made it feel similar, that imprinted. But I would say when you feel that in your body, you know, where do you feel that? Just breathe into it. Inside, outside, shape, size, color. How old might you be? What comes to mind? And then, of course, they're going to say, I think a number six, but I don't remember anything at six. I think I must be making it up. I'm like, that's how this technique works. I said, go with the flow. Trust six. And let's see where you are when you're six. I always say, I'm making it up. I don't know why I would say six. I'm like, I'm teaching you the technique as we do it. This is how it works. You're about six. I said, breathe into it. Just relax and see what happens next. You're six. Can you see where you might be when you're about six? What's happening when you're about six? So, so the body will move in that direction.
She's been able to talk about it so far in session and not be too triggered. So I was wondering if I maybe even need to have like a stock picture or the sound to play to try to trigger her, or is that too much?
I would just say, see if she'll come up with it herself. If she doesn't or can't, then you might want to get a little more over. Like, well, let's look at, can you bring a picture of one or something like that? Or you want me to bring a picture? This is like locusts or grasshoppers or what is
just
she afraid of?
The cicadas. And she knows the 20-year cicadas are coming back to Chicago in a few years. So she's working on this way ahead of time.
Wow, okay.
But occasionally over the summer, there were stuff that triggered her.
If she was in Egypt and attacked by a plague of locusts or something. No, I'm just kidding. maybe she's a lifetime in Egypt. Like, Moses, look out, be careful. So, but I'm not sure. Maybe she lived in Louisiana. We had locusts everywhere in Louisiana.
She does recall.
I guess if something happened as a child, there was a sound or something unpleasant. Now, it may be that there happened to be a cicada in the scene nearby when there was a car accident, or mom hit daddy, or daddy hit mom, or a bad thing happened. And whatever is incorporated, whatever's in your stomach, we're learning more and more about the sensory sensitivity. What's in your stomach, your senses, your face, what's in your body at the time the bad thing happens can become a phobia, can become incorporated as a protective act. Macaroni and cheese in your tummy when daddy's strangling mommy, you know the story from me, you know, and suddenly you're dairy gluten intolerant. Eating an ice cream cone and they tell your daddy drops dead of a heart attack, you're going to be the most lactose intolerant person on the planet. The body's incorporating this as death. We're dying. It's a threat. It's a danger. So something happened. I mean, this cicada thing, people have really weird little triggers sometimes. Like, that's not normal. This had to be part of a memory. I said, when did this happen? Where did this come from? That'll be interesting to kind of research that, see where it comes up for her.
Okay. Yeah, I'll let you know.
Karen, do you know if she's sound sensitive? Is she sensitive to sound?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, the reason being is cicadas, the sound that a cicada makes, but is designed human nature to frighten people. Hmm. That's why it's designed to make animals run away. And I was just thinking if she ever heard a large amount of them, because I have been in a place with cicadas all firing off at one time, and it left an impression.
I bet.
So that's just a thought I had, you know.
The only thing we've been able to connect is that there was one evening where she was watching the news and heard about riots that were happening close to where she lived for the first time ever, and then her aunt called later to tell her about cicadas. And so she was wondering if she might be associating the fear of hearing about the riots to the news about cicadas, that it somehow kind of got blurred in there. So we had that option explored too. But other than that, she thinks it might have been there when she was a kid, but she doesn't really remember. But as an adult, it's excruciating for her this summer.
That's interesting what you just said about that, when there is an associated phenomenon, like a phone call with something, where it's mentioned, that's a little bit too coincidental, you know, for that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Generally, what you want to look for as the life context when there are phobias like this is it's often not really about the object. It could be anything. So the story I used to tell is a client that ran into mommy and daddy's bed. This is about nightmares and children. So a client that heard a scratch on the window in her bedroom, and it's like, oh my God, you know, imaginary, the 3 to 5 year old is very magical imagination. And she's like, there's a monster trying to get in my window. Oh my God. So she ran to her mommy and daddy's bed, jumped in like, there's a monster trying to get in my window. What do mommy and daddy do? Instead of going and check the window, they're like, it's like, there's nothing. And you're just imagining, you're just dreaming, go back to bed. Well, that is the wrong thing to say. Because the moment you say that, it's like, oh my God, they don't believe there's a monster trying to get in the window. And I think it turned out to be, in the end, they went to look the next day, it was a branch brushing against her window. The tree had grown, and the branch, the wind was blowing in the winter, and the branch was hitting the window. So there was a scratch. She was right, like, oh, well, we'll just trim the tree, it'll be fine, it's just a branch that hit your window. So, but then it didn't matter. She had already incorporated, like, something's trying to get in, and what's the big trauma? What is the real trauma? There are always two things with these kinds of phobias. There's the trigger mechanism itself, and there's how the caregivers handle it. So the mechanism itself is there really is a threat. And if they go walk in like, oh, there's nothing in your closet, you're imagining things. Although children sometimes see things come out of their closets that adults don't see. Some of the children were very empathic. Some of you were very empathic. Jeanette probably saw stuff. And like, oh my God, there's a ghost in the room. Things are happening. You know, like nobody believes me. So if nobody believes you, what is the message? No matter what happens, I'm not going to be protected. There's no one here to make me safe. So with this client of yours with these phobias, I'd go to safety. Look for safety in her childhood. If there's no safety, no protector, like the ants calling and like, oh yeah, and there's cicadas making noises outside. Oh my God, and there's riots in the city and now the crow, whatever, the grasshoppers are coming. Like, you know, if you're not safe, the smallest trigger mechanism can create a huge reaction. And I think it's from a prehistory of a lack of safety. So I'd go to her history, take a look and see what might have created the lack of safety in her family. Were her parents there? Were they protected? Were they emotionally available? Were they there for her? Were they not?
And the family member,
the aunt called and said something about the cicadas. That's interesting. It actually is the family members that says something that scares, instead of comforting her, it kind of scares her. And like, instead of saying, oh, we're going to be fine, riots, don't worry about that. You know, oh, by the way, listen, I can hear there are cicadas outside my house right now. Like, so she's frightened. Now she's being more frightened by a relative. So instead of a relative comforting her, what's interesting is the relative increased her fear. So I think there's a pattern when something happened in her life. What I look for is an event where something took place when she needed comforting, something else happened that aggravated her fear. And for some reason, cicadas are tied to it. Or maybe at that moment, look, they're not going to protect me. Nobody's going to be here for me. And once again, bad things are happening and there's no one here to protect me. And my aunt's talking about cicadas. She's not talking about protecting me. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff I look for when I think and process with clients. I take what they're saying and then I look at the context. And often you can find the phobia within the context, lack of safety, no safety. I had a client worked with me recently about fear of flying. I have two of them lately that did the fear of flying thing. We found the memory, both were on airplanes. They did have a bad airplane experience. We reframed it and they flew home. And they were like, they weren't necessarily super comfortable, but I taught them to breathe safe, seeing color, reframe, what is your color for safety on an airplane, undo the event. Most of the time these phobias, there is a precipitating event. And you look for it, you can find it. Or it's something like that, like there was something scary happening and nobody believed me when I said it, so I know I'm not safe. So it's not really about cicadas, it's like if the cicadas come, who's gonna be there for me? Am I all alone dealing with this? You were saying something, Karen, I think you were gonna comment on something also.
I just think the current media with all the riots is probably triggering her as well. That may actually be triggering the memory of cicadas.
Yeah, well, that's possible too. I mean, but you know, we are, you have job security forever, most of you, if you're doing trauma work. You know, we have these past 4 years, we have the next year. So, you know, we're in the millennium of trauma. It began with September the 11th, it began with reality TV, realization that if you fly a plane into a building and violate boundaries in front of people, if they ever had a boundary violation, they go into hypnosis, they go into their trance, and they're hooked to the TV set. So media, regardless of who's marketing what, is not your friend. Plus the politicians, everybody's escalated, they're attacking, they're making it personal, they're going after family members. I mean, it's just kind of disgusting. There's no ethics to any of this anymore. The only person that's going to maintain any ethical integrity
for your census is going to have to be you. I haven't done it yet, but I plan to watch 5 minutes of commercials at some point in the next week or two. And I'm going to count how many violent images are used to trigger my trans phase or try to trigger people's transes. I mean, you've got the insurance companies where there's a moose eating your van, things are, meteors are falling on houses. I mean, you know, things are being eaten and blown up all over the place. They found if they can give a shock effect and do graphic something, then your subconscious is engaged and their ratings go up. Why did their ratings go up? Because you're not turning off, switching channels. You're now in trance. They've activated your 95% subconscious trance mechanism. And everybody who had a boundary violation, hello, this is Earth. The definition is Earth is love and boundary violations. You know, that's the two things that we try to have happen that do occur here. So, you're not going to have Earth is trauma school. 15 to 50 memories routinely we process an hour. And if while you're watching TV, you're being bombarded, you're right, sensory-wise, sound, smell, feeling, sensation. Some people that are more prone to the Asperger's type continuum, I had an Asperger's father. I have secondary Asperger's sensitivity. I can't do crowds. I go almost deaf when crowds reach a certain pitch or tone of loudness. I just can't deal with it. You can be talking to me in a restaurant, and if the decibels reach a certain level, I was in Sedona with a group of people at the end of August. And when the decibels in a restaurant, a guy was singing Hawaiian music, very lovely. But everybody in the restaurant started getting louder to talk louder than the Hawaiian music. And at that point, when it all started reverberating, I was so proud, I almost walked out because I could look at anybody at the table and when their mouths were moving, I could not hear a thing. I couldn't make sense of a single word that they were saying. It was impossible. It's like my brain was shutting down, like, wah. It's like being bombarded, sensory bombardment. I'm like, this is not gonna work. I can't hear anything. I can't distinguish between one thing and the other. It's like complete, like wah, 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 wah sort of a thing. And I'm like, why? They wanted to listen to Hawaiian music and go to dinner as a group. I can't hear anything the group is saying. And then thank God the Hawaiian guy ended early and left. So we get like, oh, now we can have dinner and talk to each other and find out what's really going on, conversation. But, that kind of sensory sensitivity, some of us have that kind of, when you're wanting to be in a quiet place, still place. You have to meditate more, go to your meditation place, go to the point of intelligent infinity, whatever you call it, go to the still quiet place and reclaim your integrity and then be aware if you spend time, I have a very quiet existence. I'm not around crowds and loud noises. And like Jeanette was saying, next time you're walking around, you see people sitting out, I'm like, oh wow, that would mean like a park or something. I wonder what those look like nowadays, That's been March. I don't think I've been to one, except for Sedona. There are people kind of walking around Sedona with little masks on and things like that. So I'm like, well, I really don't go out in public anymore. I didn't do a whole lot before, but I don't do a lot now either. So I'm like, okay, that would be interesting. So, but sensory bombardment is a big issue. And I think it's just getting louder and more digital and noisier. And they think if they make it louder or flashier, that it's going to get your attention. So there's always something new they're trying. So we're in the age of reality TV, kind of like, they're trying to bombard us continuously with things. And so the only person that's going to take care of you and bring that down. So I would recommend, same thing Andrew Wass said, you got to take in as much good information as you do bad. You have to, if you're going to watch something, watch nice TV programs, nurturing things, positive news. That's not going to be here till after the election, I'm afraid, So don't hold your breath on that. Somebody's going to blow something up or somebody's relatives doing something or like, just kind of be prepared for craziness with the media. And we got a month to go and then it'll take a couple months for it to wind down. And what Jerry Thomas says, by March, we're kind of regrounding as a country and the economy and everything. So it'll take a while about that. But you're in the millennium of trauma. That's what this is about. We're learning about decision-making and, trauma, and that we're in the absolute middle of it. And so sensory bombardment, it's louder, it's noisier, it's more aggressive, it's false accusations, it's lies. It's like, how do you filter that out? A lot of people are like, yeah, just don't have a TV. We just got rid of the TV. We're not going to have a TV. We're not going to do TV. And it's like, okay. That might be a wise thing to do. Doesn't matter. My phone keeps talking to me, giving me news. I tried to shut it up, turn off the app. It still won't shut up. Like, they make it so, Google makes it so you can't turn off the assistant. You know, it's like, I'm going to assist you no matter what you do, and you're going to still get information from me. And like, you know, strangle the droid. You know? So anyway, we've got to take care of ourselves. Other questions, things going on about that? What time are we? I have no idea what time you are. Well, time flies and we're having fun, huh?
So, Brent, I've got a question. I had a client today, and so what happened is she went into the initial memory, and then she went into a sub-memory, and then she went into a sub-memory of the sub-memory, and then she went into a parallel memory of the sub-memory.
Right.
And we only had time, really, to deal with two of the memories. And so what I did with the other two memories is I just put them in the safe box to deal with them in the future. But I was wondering if you had any ideas on how I could have worked with that better.
I think you're doing it, you're tracking. The fact that you recognize sub, and then parallel, it's like, yeah, exactly. You're doing exactly what you got to do. And it's tricky because you run out of time.
Yeah.
I have a little extra time to reframe the backup to the memories, but you got to honor the client's tracking process. So that's what I like in my private practice. Like the clients that drive into work with me, it's great. Because like, we'll go as long as we need to go. We could do an hour and a half to 2 hours. And we did 2.5 hour sessions, a couple of them. Like, we just start working and we talk. Sometimes we're processing things. We can slow it down, talk about it. But when you're pressed for time and your insurance is covering or, you know, whatever, you're bound by your time. You're going to have to do exactly what you did and make a note of it. That's where I like the software. If you haven't done the software, you know, people are going to set it up. Jeanette, we were talking about that. So whether you're just certified or in training, like do 6 months of free access to the software and get used to using it, touch screen recording, you know, whether you do it during the session or after. Most of the data is entered, so you can actually enter quite a lot just touching the screen. And their eyes, if their eyes are closed during the reframing, they don't know you're touching anything anyway. So it's and in COVID era, you're not supposed to be touching anyway. So you're not supposed to. So now the software is really much more useful than I originally designed it to be. Like, a lot of people are going to be able to track all the memories of your client from day one. And it's not a HIPAA document. It's a worksheet. Yeah. Send them the worksheet with a summary of all the memories, the summary of the memory data, and the map of the body. Those are three little worksheets for your client. You know, plus I'm working at Miraval, which is a hotel, so we're not HIPAA required anyway. So, you know, I have worksheets. My clients love their little worksheets. They take it home with all their colors and the memories they use, the colors they use for the memories. Because if you're really present to your client, by the time you hit the third, fourth, fifth memory, you don't remember necessarily the color from the first memory unless you have an eidetic memory. And thank you, but I don't want an eidetic memory for trauma. I don't think I want to remember all of my clients' details of all their trauma memories. But the software is really nice for touchscreen recording that data and having that available. My client that just drove out, did what, 42 memories and 42 ones and twos in the time that we had to work. All an average of 10 to 12 memories per session.
Wow.
Great job. Really, like bam, 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 bam. Clear, does a lot of body work, already, you know, knew the memories, knew where they were, cleared it out. I could feel it leave. She felt it leave. Both of us are empaths. Both felt it come, both felt it go. Flawless work, flawless session. She's like, thanks, I've been wanting to do this for years. I'm sorry I didn't come sooner. Yeah. The timing is everything. So, hopefully the time comes and you can be selective. And like, yeah, I'm going to do personal work with people. They're going to come in. And so you can have two practices. You can have your PT practice, but you can also have your spiritual counseling trauma thing or like Carrie does. Carrie's like, yeah, want to do 100-minute sessions, or have people will start flying in to work with you. Set it up like the Maui intensive, like Ray and Judy did with, it's public now, it's in the media, so like they did with Jeff Bezos and the Amazon people. You know, they fly in and stay for a month and do HMR work once or twice a day and then take a day off, go sailing or do something. You'll have people that come in for days or weeks. I haven't had anybody come in for that long. Actually, that's not true. I had a client that came in for a month. He came in for a week, like, this is great, I'm coming back, I'm doing more. Came in and did 3 weeks in a row and stayed at the Westin La Paloma for $80 a night. This is pre-COVID era. But she stayed for a month. He gave her a discounted rate, you know, we were staying that long. But, you know, yeah. And did incredible work, you know. This was like an ALS, PLS kind of a person. that was getting severe pathology, but knew that it was trauma based. Unfortunately, by the time she found me, the pathology had already been kind of anchored in her body quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And it was hard, but we got some progress on that. So, but you know, that's a luxury. Yeah, I'd like to say, I wish our sessions were designed and the time commitment of the client was such that we could do all the memories in the time we have.
Yeah.
But like, even if you try that, like, what would I do with the client? But she came for an 80-minute session for herself, and then her husband wanted to stay, so I did 250 minutes technically. And she's the one that had 25 surgeries, so I'm trying to give her a picture and take a history in like 60 minutes of what she needs to do with her body facial dysmorphia. What the heck do you do when you're that time limited? But if they're coming to you and they know what they're getting into and what you do for a living, like the clients that are calling and wanting to fly in, that'll be resumed. It's already resumed now that they can come in securely, work with me for several days, and then stay secure, social distance, buy their food, bring it with them if they want, drive in, drive back out. That would be great. I'm safer with that than I am with Miraval. Although Miraval hasn't had any cases occurring with guests at this point, do we know? And staff, there's only been one, and they got something from outside exposure, but they didn't give it to staff. They're tracking everybody. Even my lecture, though it's free, they know everybody that's at my lecture. So if anybody ever tests positive or is exposed, I think in the spa they're doing temperature tests. If anybody shows up positive, they could track back to who was exposed to what. And we're fine. We haven't had any occurrences of any sort at this point. But, So yeah, so that is tricky. Like, what do you do with that? That's where I say either write it down or, you know, try to get through the memory. I did the same thing with a client. She went into a memory, she went into a sub-memory, then she went, exactly what she did today. She went into a memory, sub-memory, third sub-memory, and the sub-memory had a parallel, the third sub-memory. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, let's do that one. Now we got to back up to this one. Let's do that. Okay, but we got to back, and I remembered to go all the way back to the originating memory. I'm like, do we have a color on that one yet? I looked at it, and when I touched the software, like, oh, look, there's no color. We didn't finish the reframing there. But the good news, if it's a level one that goes into a sub-level two, the level two solution often incorporates the six-year-old of the level one. They're like, oh, no, we don't need to go back to that one, but I do need to back it up. Yeah, right, exactly. Karen's showing me from the research, they had one client, the Japanese client, that we were trying to get to a memory. She actually had a repressed memory, which Dr. Kowal couldn't believe, came up for the first time at the end of an hour. She says, usually you don't have a person come out of deep delta, a repressed, completely unconscious, repressed memory, go conscious in 50 minutes to an hour. And at the, you know, what we did is basically, and you could see why she couldn't access it. Well, that happened, but there was a worse memory, there's something to that and something to that. What we're building down to is the bottom memory Karen showing you on the graph was the repressed memory that was so bad that she couldn't really access it. But by creating, slowly walking into it, we were able to slowly get down. And then at that point, it came up. And then you see there's a yellow diagram. So what Judy did this session with her, Judy Lefebvre, what she did was created an enhanced safe scene and said, let's invite all the parts that were active today. We didn't get resolution to everything, but we can invite all the parts that were active to go with us to a beautiful, safe place and know we're going to work on them next time. So an option you would have with that is invite all the parts like to a box or container or a safe place in the safe house. Or one thing I do is like to get them in the present moment. If you have a bunch of parts that are triggered but are not yet, you haven't worked on the memories, an option might be to see if you can get them to the safe scene and maybe create an enhanced, like one thing I often do is have a waterfall. And Lynn Cardula, who's currently the president of ASAP, she does the same thing. She'll like have the part walk through a beautiful waterfall in the safe scene and wash away the anxiety, the tension of the memory for now, and then bring them to the safe house. So when you walk through the waterfall, whatever shame or affect you're having right now kind of goes away for now. And then they can go stay in the safe house for right now, even if we didn't get to reframe the memory. So that might be an option to do a little, can we add like a little waterfall? The minute the children walk through the waterfall, it's like sexual abuse. Let's wash away the shame for now. We'll work on those memories next time when we have time. Most of the time I'd work on the memories and still have the kids walk through the waterfall, go to the safe house. They're in the safe. The minute they walk through the waterfall, all the shame, the affect from the past, they're in the present moment. When you come out of the waterfall, you're in present time awareness. The safe scene is always in present time. And you can give them their own little rooms and bedrooms and quilts and comforters and things, you know, in the safe house, in the safe room. And then tuck them in bed and let them know they're safe. So you could use a container. You could use the house as a container for the parts that you didn't get to work on and say, would they like to, for now, at least just go to the safe house and be there until maybe we can reframe the memories. And if you usually talk to the parts and let them know that you're going to work on them in the future and say, we know you're there, we're going to work on you, can we send you a color, you know, then they'll kind of calm down and tell the client, if you need to use your safe color between now and the next time we work, do that. And then we'll pick up with these memories next time. Okay. People have used a golden box, high frequency, put the memory in a golden box, or change it to black and white for now. Take out the color, the emotion, change it to black and white. Let's put it in the golden box with a lock on it. You have the key. Or give the key to your angel, Michael the Archangel, to your guardian angel, so it's all safe and you won't have to work on anything until you're ready. So let's put that in the box and lock it up and it's safe, and then run your safe colors. And if anything else comes up, we can add that to the box and we'll work on it next time. I mean, that's if you gotta do it, you know. Most of the time with the luxury I have now, I just don't end a session without addressing most of the came off. I think sometimes when you get into too many subs, I end up letting one or two slip by sometimes, you know, but you'd like to go back and deal with those. Yeah. The worst kind of the worst, if you miss the memory, it's still in the body, it's just going to come back up in the body again, right? So you don't have to get do it the exact same way you accessed it this time. Like, oh, when you think about those memories now that we didn't get to work on, where do you feel that in your body now? Not just probably go back to the body and resume with whatever comes up. I think it can even change the sequencing pattern between sessions. If she gets another memory or two, it might get longer or shorter or change a little bit. So I think we try to work with the client with where they're at the moment. But those are a few safety things that I've used and to maintain in between.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Sure. Other questions, cases, comments? You're all looking good. I think Glenda's going to say.
I have a comment going back to your talk about television. You know, we haven't watched television for many years, and purposely. But it's gotten to yesterday. The day before, I got so upset by all the lying and obfuscating and everything else in the news that I said, I can't even read the newspaper anymore. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to read it today. Well, by evening time, I was so upset because, you know, there are more things in the newspaper than all these politicians and all this other crap that's going on. So today I says, well, you know, I can read my newspaper, but I can go buy all this political stuff, all these other things. I do not need to read. I do not need to pay attention to it. So at least that got me away from my irritation that it took because these people are, you know, lying and all this crap, that took away from me all the other things in the newspaper that I want to read, that it's good for me to read. You know, I read a wonderful article about travel and all this other stuff. So that's what I did today. So I feel much better. But that's just what you say. You have to take care of yourself. And that's, right. You know, that's one way I'm trying to handle it, because it's really been getting to me. And then you hear about, even in our community, you know, people are being mean and nasty. having to do with the election. Well, that's, you know, that's uncalled for. This is something we have to be aware of and pull away from some.
Well, there's a very aggressive stuff going on. Yeah. So you have to, it's very traumatic because the ethics went out the window with September the 11th, and sensory bombardment is the predominant method of trying to get, it's trying to engage yourself. If I was a terrorist, what I would do is I would blow up your Twin Towers, hit your stock market twice. I'd go for the pocketbook that hits the financial conservatives the worst. So I'd go after your pocketbook and hit the Twin Towers. Then I'd probably drop a plane on the Pentagon because I want your defense system, your defense archetype to go down. And then I'd go for your center of leadership and hope that I wiped out your president and your leadership by hitting the Capitol. Well, at 2001, that's what they did. They went for the largest fear factor possible in the subconscious. We call that, what do they call that? Exogenous archetypes are when they use external symbols to try to create fear. Endogenous is when your own little body creates, like, oh, look, there's a lump in my throat, or there's a vice on my head. You know, these are the ones your body is generating. But exogenous is when they take something like a Twin Tower and try to turn it into a symbol for terrorism. So terrorists, when they try to frighten you, manipulate you by engaging your profound levels of fear in your subconscious. There's a lot of, there's just a lot of manipulation that's been going on. And unfortunately, we're facing, you know, 20 years. We had 10 years of uncaught perpetrator. Mm-hmm. So once they blew everything up and terrorized everybody and we went into fear and anger, there was no targeted perpetrator caught. So there were 10 years of simmering rage and simmering fear. So the society went into, you know, road rage, went to rage, went to, it started with me by media. It ended back with media and the Me Too thing and whatever else is going on. But all the uncaught rage in your subconscious has been stimulated and brought into the foreground. So people are electing and seeing and trying to resolve their rage through external selection and choices, and it doesn't work that way. You know, we have to reduce our rage internally and calm our inner rages and our inner fears. And when we resolve the anger and the fear, the powerlessness, and go to a peaceful moment, then we make good decisions. And we tend to make, you know, we elect representatives that represent who we feel like, you know, kind of a thing. Whereas if you're an angry person, you're going to elect an angry representative of your voice. Mm-hmm. You want to express your rage. So they're going to pick the angry candidate. So, you know, whether it's Democrat or Republican, whether it's an anger and fear, like one is codependent, one is counterdependent, nothing's changed in history for the past 140,000 years. We're still looking at rage and fear as our two polarities. And it's showing up, you know, like, oh, can't make a decision. Oh, make excessive decisions. You know, is there anything different? You know, it's really a healing opportunity for us as a society to look at the polarizations and say, it's not just about that. It's going to continue as long as people don't step back and do their own part to, always said, you know, we'd have great negotiations in the Middle East and everything if we could bring the parties together in the same room and do trauma resolution. We could get everybody out of their trauma states. Because if you say brother, and I know that you sent a missile that killed my brother, I'm going to go into a rage because you said brother. And then you're going to say something, president, like, well, you shot our president. One day you tried to kill him, and so I'm furious about it. You tried to do something to our president. So nobody can hear each other when the shame and the 95% have activated. There's no authentic communication. And now they've bombarded and overstimulated the senses with this kind of continuous bombardment. So what are we able to hear in order to make a healthy decision? You get confused, like, who do we trust? Everybody's elaborating, and it seems like it's on no holds barred. Mm-hmm. But if somebody's screaming and yelling at you, and, you know, let you have your voice, you're gonna raise your voice to try to get a word in edgewise. It's like, you know, this isn't gonna work. You know, yeah. You're just gonna have to mute the damn mics and shut everybody up so you can say your piece, and just leave it alone. And then make a decision based on what's going on with that. So, you know, but for you and I, the voices, our clarity and decision-making for each of us comes when we silence the silence the rage, silence the fear, do your own trauma work, and then, you know, the goal is to have leaders that we have options to vote for, elect, that are trauma free. Mm-hmm. We do not have that right now. You know, both of our candidates have had a lot of trauma, and some go to rage and some go to fear. And you know, we just have, everybody on earth is in trauma school right now. So there's a bigger picture. Your work is needed. What each of you is doing is very important right now at this time. Mm-hmm. You know, and to get us to a place where we're in a post-trauma state, I don't think Biden has my books. Mrs. Pence has my latest book, but I'm not sure it's going to do any good. Poor guy, he had a fly on his head, and I don't know what the heck is going to happen to him. You know, he's like traumatized, but craziness is afoot. They're not talking about the debate. They're talking about the fly on Pence's head. I'm like, you know, by the time you're that dissociative as a society, it's like just, crazy making, you know.
So I've also noticed there is so much projection going on. I've never seen that much projection going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when there's so much fear and anger inside that's been stimulated, we had 10 years with the September the 11th theme of the uncaught perpetrator. But what it activated in the subconscious is everybody who ever had uncaught, unheld, accountable perpetrators. So it went educational system, wait a minute, corporate systems, dishonesty, then it went educational systems, then it went religious, actually it went political, then it went religious, then it went back to media, like media moguls that are being dishonest, and then it's back into government things. And so there's no system that was not activated with rage and anger, that if you ever had your boundaries violated and the memories weren't healed, you got stimulated by what's taken place in the last 20 years, particularly. And it's not slowed down. There's always somebody trying to target somebody outside of them. But, you know, that's not how we heal our trauma memories. We have 140 million years, 7.9 million confirmed, of accumulated trauma on this planet. And we're wondering why everybody's so pissed off or shame-based. And we've been accumulating and accumulating, and then we started using trauma and emotional overwhelm as entertainment. And we told ourselves it was okay because it's on the TV. And the reality TV thing never was okay. The video games, it was never okay to sanction violence. Anything as a society we give permission to watch occurs inside our physiology. You know, what you're looking at me right now, the photons of light are bouncing off Brandon Prittney on the retina camera, going to the camera, going into your retinas upside down on your retinas. This thing is upside down. And you're actually experiencing this whole thing inside your physiology through Zoom right side up. So everything we give ourselves permission to watch and observe, we are admitting into our temple. So you're right, Glenda, about that. It's like, well, if you're going to stay calm through this whole election conflagration, you've got to increase your meditation, increase your yoga, be nice to yourself, eat right, get your rest. You know, some things will subside with time, you know, but you've got to be a bastion and an example, actually, for self-care at this point. The media will not be doing any of this. It's just escalated.
That's a curious point you bring up, because that has happened to me this year with my book group. They had chosen several books that are very violent or have to do with abusive situations. Mm-hmm. And I have told them, I read the first abusive book because that's what I do. I mean, mm-hmm. I read the books they choose, but I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. You choose books like this, and I'm not going to read them. Oh, well, why not? I said, because that is not entertainment for me. Mm-hmm. I have to make it better, and I can't make it better because, you know, I mean.
Well, I did a podcast recently. I did a podcast with Tim and Pam recently, and one of the questions that one of the listeners asked was, why are people so attracted to horror and trauma and things like that? And I'm like, well, it's like you said, you know, if you've been stimulated for 10 years and adrenaline without resolution, then part of the subconscious attraction is trying to find a way to get resolution to it and to make it end. And so when we get sympathetically, holographically triggered into a horror scene or an aggressive scene, and then the movie ends or the show ends, or we try to get some closure to it, there's a momentary sense of relief, but it doesn't really resolve anything at all. It's not doing the resolution piece. So without realizing it, people have upped the ante on the anger in the last decade, and then again in this decade, it's higher. The potential for road rage, anger is not de-escalating, it's escalating, it's going a little bit higher. And once we realize that this is all trauma-based and we hold ourselves accountable, it's like, okay, we can clear ourselves. And it's the same thing, it's how to view your client. They're coming in with so much anger and so much triggered. But your current anger is gonna be amplified by any prehistory of anger. So anything we can do to heal the past in our client is gonna bring it. All we'll be left dealing with is what's real and current in present time. And that's where I'm at. I'm like, I'm going to release my traumas from the past, whatever judgments, political, other kinds of things. I'm just going to be present to what's here and make the best decisions I can from what I'm experiencing. You know, the whole Agents of Chaos movies came out with the HBO and the GRU, the Russians really were trying to, it wasn't particularly targeting. It was trying to just create division. And they targeted for the previous election, the current election. They're just creating social media chaos to create division. And you and I are all suffering because of the division, whether we think it's Democrat, Republican, it's much bigger than that. It's literally creating dissociation because they know that the way to undermine society or culture is create dissociation. And if you can trigger a society's already present associative potential, then there's gonna be potential powerlessness and disempowerment proportionate to the prehistory of trauma society carries. What they don't realize is it's gonna trigger so much rage and everything. Once we find out they're doing it, we turn it on them, you know, that the people that have set this up, and they're gonna be held accountable. So, you know, things will come back around, but ultimately it's like, you know, okay, if you're going to de-escalate this, the good news is the one computer you have management over, you could de-escalate this is your own. I breathe, what colors do I breathe in my body to center myself, to calm myself? You know, leaders will come and go, political parties will come and things will come and go, you know, but in the end, it's like, how are you and I going to be safe navigating whatever comes? You know, and that's listening to your own integrity and your truth. And hopefully enough of us will get that going that we'll navigate our way through this and be fine. Mm-hmm. So, but that's kind of how I view my clients too coming in right now. The client acuity has escalated in the past few weeks too. And I kind of expected that around the time of an election, everybody's agitated and people get very frightened in times of an election like this. They're financially more anxious and destabilized. And so they're coming in with a lot of anxiety and fear, and some people are decompensating. So you can expect some like mental stuff, illness coming at you from different clients and people. They're gonna decompensate a little bit. And there's a lot of polarization right now. Mm. They're polarizing into the rage and the fear camps. And both parties are doing rage and fear camps on both sides. I got both parties texting me like, well, look at the video of what so-and-so did. Look at the video of what so-and-so did. I'm like, oh my God. Like, I'm not gonna believe this stuff. What's the point? I voted a week ago. It's like already done deal. Come on, give me a break. Mailed in the damn ballot. I'm sure it's gone where it's supposed to go. You know, it's like, eh. You know, so I'm at peace. I've done my part, what I can do to help the world grow and change. But the biggest thing is we got to get this out there. We got to get these kinds of techniques where if we can get people out of their excessive anger and then of excessive fear, they're going to make better decisions. You know, they're going to be in a more balanced place. So stay tuned. By the time we do our next meeting, the election will be over.
Hallelujah.
So we'll see what happens in post-traumatic election reframe. Okay, there we go. We'll be fine. Good. So any other questions? Yeah, thanks for hanging in there a little extra longer, but you know, Increase your self-care. I'm picking up vibes and stuff from outside. I mean, it's definitely just bombarded right now. So it's in the general airwaves right now. This chaos out there. So do your black tourmaline, draws out negativity. You know, it's really good for you. Shungite, black tourmaline, clears negativity. Citrine, golden light in and around you. Your heart meridians, watch your heart meridians. They're really going after disturbances in the heart, feminine and masculine, your heart balances. Stay grounded, use brown earth tones, stay grounded. That will be good for you. And same thing for your clients. You know, the client that just came in, I sent her away with shungite and brown marble for grounding, and a piece of pink thulite. She was doing a lot of work with pink. Pink is a thulite is a pink form of zoisite. It's really quite nice. So anyway, use what you need to do. Yes, level 3 has been canceled. So the crystal workshop you're going to do for fun, alas, that's canceled also. So maybe by next year, maybe by retreat, but I'm not sure that our March retreat is going to be able to happen.
Yeah.
Beginning to look like, you know, if we don't have a vaccine or something out, it's going to be pretty pretty upsetting, you know, but
yeah.
It may be 2022 in Tucson when our next retreat occurs, so stay tuned. I may try to do a virtual, like Scott, I think Scott, you're still there, yes, I see your phone number still on anyway. We may try to do some kind of like a breathing training thing and support Scott, support this, do breath work, because I was talking to Scott recently, and one of the things we talked about was the fact that he doesn't have to do much level 2 parts therapy, because when you get a person to a breathing place of safety, it becomes almost pure HMR, just memory tracking. So the parts are not so distinctive or articulated, it appears, that when we do the breath work and the body just begins unwinding and mapping its history of sequencing. So the level 2 parts work may not be such a significant phenomenon once we have really grounded and established adequate safety. So it may be really about safety and grounding. And I've always said parts are just a combination of the different groupings of memories. But if we create enough safety, the body will then spontaneously begin to unwind its parts history. I haven't done parts work very much in quite a while, really. But I think it may be that when the parts come up, it's a sign that enhanced safety must be instituted first. And at that point, then the HMR moves more smoothly with the breath work and the integration. So you may not need to learn the IFS piece. But... Scott?
Brent, I just unmuted here. What I have found is if I focus on making sure that the number one issue that I'm watching is to maintain client balance and low stress level, and only go after traumas willingly or intentionally when the client is under control, then the system is very smooth. Everything unfolds, and even what one of the questions was earlier about having or not being able to find out about the cicada to track that back. And if the client doesn't have any really explosive traumas, and if I've already taught them breathing, which I teach them breathing in their very first session, which empowers them and starts the process of them being in control of their trauma, so that I'm still there to facilitate, but they gradually over time become more empowered. And one of the components of trauma or being traumatized is you felt powerless. Things were out of control. So I kind of use giving the client control and empower them from the very first session. And we keep building on that. And I watch their energy level during a trauma session, so that if their energy level spikes and they start getting high anxiety, I do not proceed with the processing I go right back to the breathing, and and it only takes about five minutes for them to breathe themselves down from a very activated state if they're used to breathing. And so then we process the trauma at a level 4 or level 5 anxiety, rather than at an 8, 9, 10, which is going to get pretty messy. And so if you're always conscious of what level of stress, what level of anxiety is the client at, and if that's a prime awareness that you have each session, they run very, very smooth. And as far as locating back, like the cicada thing, if I've done a few sessions and I feel that the client is stable, and if they don't have any extremely severe traumas like abductions or very early childhood sexual abuse that was overwhelming, and if I think that their system has stabilized, then I use progressive relaxation to help the client get in a more relaxed state. And they're still very conscious, they're still very aware. And in that state, there are a few regression techniques which I'm not gonna speak necessarily about here, because I'm not sure whether using regression techniques, you know, very simple techniques, they're not complicated at all, but I'm not sure that it's proper for me to teach people or to talk about simple regression techniques if they don't have any hypnosis training, because then they'd be using some methods that they really haven't been trained in, and it could possibly lead to a problem. But it's very, very simple using a hypnosis technique, just in general, like taking them back along the timeline, going down an elevator where each floor is related to one of their ages. Like if they're 31, they start at the 31st floor, they start going down. And if they're in a relaxed state, they stop at the age, at the floor where the trauma is, and then they identify it. Or you go through, you ask them to imagine being in a hallway of doors, and they're already in a relaxed state. You start counting, and at 10, they find themselves in front of a door, and each door is a number of their ages, and they open the door in, and 9 times out of 10, the trauma is right there. So there are ways, if you use relaxation, if you focus on maintaining their balance rather than on an up and down session, it goes much smoother, you got better access, and they process most traumas at a 3, 4, or 5 out of 10, and a really activated trauma only goes up to an 8, it really, or, you know, a 7, 8, uh-huh, most of uh-huh. the time. It doesn't reach the panic attack.
Right. Well, you know, and I think, Carrie, you can use tapping to give a person a sense of control or power over their own bodies, their life, you know, kind of thing. I think they use the EFT, TFT techniques also to give you a sense of self-control over your body. So I think the whole key is establishing safety in the system and maintaining safety. So yeah, and the traditional regression protocols, different people integrate it in different ways. So there are many possibilities for that. I think progressive relaxation is also our use of color and moving it through the somatically. You can do the progressive relaxation through the body. Sometimes I do it from the feet up chronologically. So we're doing the same thing with the elevator, but we're not doing ages per se, like the door with the number. We're like, we're starting at 0, or we could go from present day downward all the way down to conception, birth, by moving color through the body. That actually makes the body the elevator with chronology in it. So anyway, there are different methods. We'll talk about that. One thing, Scott, I was thinking about is if we don't do the retreat, maybe we can do sort of a Zoom retreat for people, and maybe somewhere in that incorporate some of your work with breathing or breath work, and can share some of the things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that might be
in March. Yeah, I think that would be a good idea that we could do it by Zoom, and I could do the breathing and add a few other things that, that are used with the breathing and to fill it out a little bit so that they can put it in a bigger context.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so let's talk more about, well, you and I will talk more about that. And yeah, and so we may have like a little day, sort of a little mini, maybe a day or two, we'll have to see, a day and a half of HMR conferences. Carrie's working with a lot of kids and teenagers and stuff. It'd be fun to share some cases about that and where we're moving with that. Might be fun to talk about integrating some energy psychology and HMR, you know, kind of how it integrates together. Scott's talking about integrating breath work and circular breathing and HMR. So it'd be nice to have a couple of you share some of your experiences about that. And, you know, we can give you a little fee of some sort. So charge people for an extra day of training or something and make a contribution to you all. So anyway, we'll talk, look at that for March. Yeah, March or whatever those dates were for our retreat. Usually we do like a Thursday through a Monday for our retreat. So we might do like a virtual. That's, I know that's what Jerry Thomas with Still Point Retreats, he flipped everything to Zoom retreats kind of a thing. So it might be our time for at least this year. I'd like to go back to actually doing it in person. But if we hit a lot more people doing it by Zoom, we may, Jeanette, we may want to talk about that and look at, do you know how many people we can handle on Zoom right now? What is our capacity? You're muted right now. I can't hear.
We can handle about 1,000.
Oh no, we're not doing that, but that's okay. That's a nice thought. I appreciate that. I didn't.
No, you have a bit, we have a business account. We can easily handle 25 people and never even, I mean, it has to do with computer screens.
Well, I think if we offered by Zoom and with Karen's marketing, you know, like we had like 12 people who do online training. If it's going to be escalating like that, we're moving into the era of trauma where HMR is a nice structural core component that can be integrated with other modalities. We're seeing a surge. So those of you that are talking about HMR, keep doing what you're doing. People are signing up for training. So we're going to have more practitioners. So that's really good. So I know you're approaching. I'm going to.
25-30 is your best number.
What's that? 25-30.
25-30.
That's correct.
For a computer screen
right.
type thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all. Unless you have any questions, we're done here. Thanks for hanging in there and be well, live long and prosper, stay calm, breathe color. You know, remember that, yeah, live long, turn off the TV, you know, like, Dr. Spock, Mr. Spock, so, okay.
Brent, hang in.
Okay, I'll hang in there for a minute with you now.
Okay.
Karen, too, you need to hang out with Karen for a minute.
Bye, thanks, everybody. Y'all.
Bye, goodbye. Be well. Okay.
Well, I have a couple of questions for you, and I know you guys have a couple of questions for me. Mm-hmm. And Karen, let me address first your question about the research
QEGs,
stuff.
QEGs, right, the research.
Do you want that to just not have anybody's name? Because I can make a PDF that you can send to anybody. Oops. Go ahead.
I lost you for a minute. Play again.
All right, do you want, there is a PowerPoint presentation that Brent built that has the QQE data or whatever in it, but it does have the people's names, first name, last name. I can edit that and change those to numbers.
I think the PowerPoint, I gave the first name and the initial.
You did. That's exactly what it has. Right. Right. But if we want to go strictly with numbers, it's very easy for me to edit it and number them.
Well, I'm thinking some people that want to look at the detailed data, they're going to correlate it to this PowerPoint in the case of the person, maybe, and what they went through, or the memory sequencing.
Okay.
So we might just want the initials. I mean, we have permission, but just two initials is not going to give away the identity of the person, I don't think, right? I think we'd be okay. So we could do the initial, the first and last letter.
I have a version you gave me that has numbers, and I have it, and I can send people, but the Dropbox one has names.
Right.
The one with the number, it has like a 5-digit number and then two letters after.
Yes, I created that.
And
that
I just feel better.
Okay. Those 5-digit numbers and two letters are actually Dr. Kowal's numbers. If you were to try to, they are his medical numbers. Okay. They map back to where he, because when he presents data out, he presents the patient's number rather than a name. Mm-hmm. So you can send that out if you want to, or I can change the PDF that Brent did that is so good, that's got all the colors and explanations and things like that, and put those, use Dr. Kowal's medical numbers, or we can leave it with the names. It's whatever works for you.
I'm having so many people ask for it at once that I just keep feeling like it needs to be available on the websites.
Okay, Michael's so gift you want to put it out to Michael's gift, where you can just give him a link to it?
I would like it. I mean, my preference is both websites, but I know Michael's gift has a special tab for research already. Yes. It's just, I feel like people are missing something if I send them only to Michael's gift. And the reason they're enticed is because they know about QEEGs. So I'm trying to send them to Brent's website, but they're also wanting the QEEGs. So I'm sending that to them manually. I just feel like it's just awkward, and I'm afraid we're losing them in the mumbo jumbo stuff.
Okay, then my recommendation is, if we want to do this, Brent, we put it on the HMR training website. We put it out there. We use one where we literally do strike the names and stuff like that, because it is a
people can get to
it publicly. Mm-hmm. And put a caveat on there, Karen, that if they want more detailed information, to contact you, and then you can email out full detailed, the 56 page, you know, all the files. Once they sign that form that we've got that says that confidentiality form.
I don't have access to that confidentiality form. I don't know if I should even have it. I kind of like having you have it. So far, nobody wants that.
Well, I have a solution for that. I use a thing with PPRC called a JOT form. I can create a JOT form and just send you the link. And what happens is that you would send them this link and say, this is the confidentiality form. You need to go fill it out. And it'll email it to me, or it can email it back to you, whichever way we want to do it. And once you've got that, as we know that we've got a record that they've done that, then you can send whatever you want to send as far as the deep details, you know, the actual original data that Dr. Kowal did, if you want to send that out.
Nobody's asked for that.
So okay.
They just want the QEEG PowerPoint.
Well, as long as it's anonymous and, you know, is pretty secure, I don't think there's any way to trace it, so.
Yeah. Okay. I just think that if we're going to end up, if we use the PowerPoint presentation that you did, Brent, that's fine. You know, I think we're fine giving that to just about anybody and actually putting it on a website. If we're going to use the original files that Dr. Kowal sent to us, if we're going to,
I don't think I want that generally available to them. No. That would be like particular researchers that are clear, maybe through the charity.
We need
to have them be a consultant to our charity or something. We could, Karen, if it's appropriate, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, we could include as a consultant to our charity or something, give him access to the QEGs that he wants to look at them. So,
well, and see, the reason being is that for Dr. Kowal, if anybody ever said anything, we need to be able to produce for him that person signed a confidentiality, which then frees him of legal responsibility. So it's the same thing that, you know.
Well, that's assuming that he got a confidentiality statement when he did the QEGs. That's assuming he did that. I'm assuming he probably did, but we were conducting the research. He was doing it for us. So maybe, well, we got confidentiality statements from all the clients. We had them sign their participation agreements. I have all that. So,
but making someone who's got that data sign one as well is that other piece of protection that says that.
Well, I'm not sure we want his medical record number used as part of our research.
No,
I don't know. It kind of reveals his medical record. record information. They could trace it back to his system.
Well, that's true. So
we might not want to be using that. Maybe use our own numerical system or something like that. Or, you know.
Well, like I said, as long as we use that PDF, Karen, we're fine.
Yeah, the PDF is fine. Yeah, I don't think
website and everything.
The other ones are kind of confusing unless you know how to interpret your QEGs. You know, you're not going to know what you're looking at real well. So.
Yeah.
So I think we're good for now. Okay. I think that presentation was pretty good. I picked the highlights for each person, the best parts of what Dr. Kual gave us, you know. So.
All right. I'll put it out on the HMR training website. And then, Karen, I can go look at the research on the.
There's a research tab on the HMR website.
Yeah.
Healing Dimensions website has that research thing. So you might want to put just a line with a hyperlink at the bottom saying research, go to, and either sends them to the charity or it sends them to the same file maybe, you know, for that summary document.
All right, let me look at that. Let me toy with that.
Because research is included at the bottom. Like there's a link for them to contribute. If we're asking them for money, you would think we'd want to give them access to the PowerPoint about, you know, what research have we done? Where is it going? What is it doing? So that would be a nice little hyperlink. So it might just be a live putting. And if you want to see previous research, you know, like it'll take them to either the Healing Dimension site, I mean the HMR training site, or take them to the charity. I think they're contributing to the charity, so it should probably take them to the research section of the Michael's Gift site.
I could do that because I can take the HMR training site and create just a page that points them over there. And okay. There's two places on the Healing Dimension site, down in the little blurb at the bottom on the front page about Michael's Gift, I can put a line that points over to Michael's Gift to the research section. And then I can go to HMR training because we're getting a lot of people that are frequenting the HMR training site. Mm-hmm. I can create a space over there that also points them. Just when they click there, they end up at the research section of Michael's Gift, and that's where we can list these different pieces of information. So they, no matter where they come into the HMR world, whether it's through Healing Dimensions, through the training site, or through Michael's Gift, they can always get to that research section.
Yeah.
That list, you know, what we're doing.
Yeah, as long as it's in one of the places and the hyperlinks, we're fine. So we're good.
Right. Well, and I'd rather do that because if we're going to make a change, I'd rather have everything in one place. So if we have to change this, we only change one place, not three places.
Right. That makes sense.
There's less chance of mistakes that way.
You have time to do that? Are you okay? Are you washed away in the floods? Are you and your doggies all in little life raft things right now? Or how are you doing in Houston? Are you okay?
Caroline? Well, I just finished. Karen texted me. I just finished this morning going through the colonoscopy and the endoscopy because I had to reschedule it when Laura came through because of the...
Oh, you're having all kinds of fun, you know, my goodness.
Yeah,
having a party, so I mean, oh my God.
Yeah, so that's why I look a little pale because I got to do it. I went in at 5:30 this morning.
Well, thank you for sharing. I appreciate that.
And I do have an ulcer. I do.
You do. Oh, well, at least I know where some of your... So, you're going to have to give up something. You know, it's either us or the dogs. One of us is going to have to go.
I had to give up ibuprofen. You're wrong.
Ibuprofen was creating. Is that Advil or is that the acetaminophen is Tylenol?
Anything. Ibuprofen. He told me today, he says, I want you off of that baby aspirin you take every morning, that 80 milligram. He said, we're going to take you off of everything for at least 30 days. And he said, I don't know if you'll, because once you do this, you have a tendency to do it again. He said, so we're going to have to see whether or not, and I'll talk to your cardiologist about whether or not you go back on the baby aspirin. I may never go back on any NSAIDs whatsoever. So I can only have Tylenol. And the reason I was taking the ibuprofens was for the pain and the headaches from this bulging disc in my neck.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm on another medicine that's supposed, it's a migraine medicine, kind of works, kind of doesn't work. So I'm going to bite the bullet in the next month or two and go back to my orthopedist and say, okay, let's talk about this again. You know, I do not want surgery. And I've told him that it's going to have to get really bad before we're going to talk about any kind of surgery on any part of my spine. I just, that is, there's a line I draw, and that's, you know, but anyway, I do get really bad headaches. Like I wake up 2 and 3 times a night because if I move a certain way, it pinches and causes pain. I'm getting better at figuring out how to sleep so I don't, if I get in just the right place.
You know, have you read John Sarno's work? Are you familiar with John Sarno? Mm-mm. He's famous in New York. He died just last year. He's famous at healing the spine naturally. And so his books are amazing. And he was totally aligned with what we do with HMR. So you may want to become our expert on John Sarno and healing the back naturally. So that would be good. But his works are very, I had a client who said she read his book and she got all her back pain to go away.
Oh, wow.
What's his last name?
S-A-R-N-O, John Sarno. And they're like, did you train with John Sarno? He's talking the way you talk, you know, about memory and the back and the spine and healing the spine naturally and does exercises. So they read one of his books and she said, I did what he said and my back pain was gone. I'm fine. So read John Sarno's work. That's a big deal.
Well, and you asked me about my anxiety. So my anxiety is better. One of the things that I discovered, and I actually had an epiphany one night, and I was thinking about, who's the guy that does the work with the horses?
Wyatt Webb, yeah.
And I was...
Oh, he's on sabbatical right now, too.
I know. Well, you, for some reason, I could hear your voice about Wyatt, and you have to be calm to work with the horses. Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you something I figured out. I don't care how sick a dog is, mm-hmm. but I have to be centered and calm in order to treat a dog, because they don't respond if I'm not. So getting back to the point where I could be centered and calm, because I mean, we've lost more dogs, you know. Mm-hmm. Now I have learned a great deal. I put in more IVs in the last month than I ever thought I would, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm getting much better at the diagnosis and deciding, you know, we got to go this way, we need to go that way. You know, Dr. May keeps saying, before long, I'm just going to send my patients to you. And I said, no, you're not. Never. But I did have to realize that in order for me to do what I wanted to do, I had to get at peace inside of me again. And I will tell you that working with animals mm-hmm. will get you calm, will get you centered. Because when you get singularly focused on them and get linked up with them, they don't have all the outside crap that human beings do. They're very focused on take care of what I need now. And I really can go down to the place with them sick as a dog, very, very sick, mm-hmm. and get very calm very quickly, you know, because I have to, you know. So my anxiety's down a little bit, you know, it's better. You know, I'm not going to say that I'm thrilled with where I am physically, but I also look at it as just, okay, what are we going to do with this? And what do you learn from it? And how do you move forward? Mm-hmm. You know, type stuff. So that's where I am. I don't get as much done because I have to rest mm-hmm. more, which aggravates me. I'd like my energy to come back a little bit better, but it'll come. I know it will. So.
Well, I'm glad your head, your chest, your butt, and your heart are all doing better. We just want everything working right. This is good.
Leave it to you. Thank you, Brent.
You're welcome. Sending you healing energy from the top to the bottom. There you go. Yeah. You feel that energy zipping up and down. There you go.
You want to generate something for me, because I know you're a powerful generator. Ooh. Go out into the universe and find me somebody who wants to help fund the healing, our endeavor.
Right. Because, you know, I actually was talking to some people that, you know, like, well, Mirabal could see some people from Houston.
Right.
And, you know, last time we asked about that, the person I was talking to was like, oh, yeah, we just moved from whatever, New York, and we're in Houston during the COVID thing, and we have a dog, a puppy with parvovirus, and the day before you'd opened the new clinic.
So yes, I'm like, I remember her.
Remember that?
And we lost that dog.
Yeah, lost the puppy. But,
I'm like, well, we'd known
sooner. They could have gotten it sooner or something like that. So you never know. So we'll ask for a parvo benefactor to show up at Miraval. And then we'll just drop them in your lap. How's that?
I think that's wonderful. And I'll tell you why, because we're working on a grant with a group called PetSet. Oh. And PetSet is founded by two ladies, and they move in the circles of philanthropers that have the kind of money that make big donations. That's their circle. So they're using that to try to fund rescue work for dogs. And she came down to the day that in the middle of my prep, I said, guys, I won't be there. You're going to have to handle this without me. She came down to see the center. And when she was there, you know, of course, she was impressed and all that kind of stuff, but she said all that. But one of the things she turned around and said to Candace, she said, I don't know whether you understand, but you guys have become the leading authority on Parvo in the Houston and surrounding area for all rescues. And when Candace told me that, I said, holy Toledo, you know, and that's what happened. Our name and what we do grew faster than our physical structure and our administrative structure. Mm-hmm. And so now we're playing catch up because there, and we knew it. I mean, I knew it. I don't think I understood how big the need was, but now I know there was this enormous need in the Houston and surrounding area for a place to treat a disease that neither shelters nor veterinarians want in their area. Mm-hmm. And we built it and we set it up. And if I had the medical personnel and I could work more hours, or if we had more people, we could easily have 15 dogs in there all the time.
Wow.
You know, which is a lot of dogs to be treated.
That is a lot of dogs, right.
But we did, there's just that kind of need. So sometimes when I tell you I'm stressed because I realize there's this huge need and this big reality of what we built, and we're not as deep in the physical, the ability of people to manifest what the need is. We're smaller than the need is. So hopefully this year we're going to start to catch up to make it more even, because I know that I can't sustain this year after year, and we know it. You know, the other two women know it, but we've saved a bunch of dogs this year.
Cool.
And if Brent, if you and I are ever alone together and you injure yourself and we need to give you fluids, I can put an IV in you.
Wow, cool.
Well, I want you to feel to reassured now.
Okay,
I've mastered another skill for you.
I feel better about that, so that's all good. Yay.
Yeah, that is if I can get you to shut up and be still long enough.
Not likely, but you never know. So. All right. Okay, well, kids,
okay,
keep up the good work.
Uh-huh, I have two more questions.
Okay.
This weekend, I need to do server maintenance.
Okay.
All right, so what time on Sunday would you be finished? Because I need you off that server when I actually do things and all that kind of stuff. Karen, come back.
Oh, she's gone.
You just keep disappearing and coming back.
I know. I haven't touched anything.
At Miraval, I'm finished at 4:30 my time, which is 6:30 your time.
Okay. So 9 o'clock, I can have the server.
Oh, yeah, sure. That evening is fine. Sure.
All right. Do you want to talk about CD Baby, or do you want me to keep doing the research and we'll talk?
You know, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with that yet.
Let me keep doing some research. I'm researching Spotify. And I think that might be the solution, because Spotify is the go-to thing that is used by many, many people right now to get music content. And they do have an ability for you to upload. I just haven't done enough research to speak and tell.
Okay, well, check it out. So that would work. The other option I'm thinking about is taking the time to convert my latest book to an audio book.
Yep.
And having the book and the exercises together on a USB drive.
That would be interesting.
Then they could just mail the USB drive, and it would still go through my supplier here, but it might be very pricey. I don't know what it'll cost me. They're advising against an independent publisher putting money into an audio book, but I think it might be helpful for posterity to have my voice, at least for that book in particular, recorded, so people can use my voice to clear whatever they need to clear. But
And I could probably record it here at a studio. I've investigated how to record it. And hopefully my voice wouldn't be too hideous or weird, you know, recording the book, reading it, or responding to it. But if I could record that and maybe put the exercises themselves on a CD set, you know, or convert it to a one, all of it on one USB drive, then they could get the audio book and the audio exercises in a single, and I don't know if I want to separate it out, but you're right. In a temporary thing, it's going to take a while to do the audio book anyway. In the meanwhile, we can see what Spotify does, if we can upload it and what their percentages are. If I record the audio book on Amazon, they're going to take 60%.
No. You don't want to do that. Don't.
So I'm thinking, you know, we can create an audio file that people could, you know, get through a USB port, plug it into a computer, transfer it, you know, from the computer to the whatever. I think there's probably a way to do that. You might have to check that out for me. If I record my own audiobook and sell it myself, you might get bigger, but you know, if through Amazon, they're going to take at least, and they're going to keep the price very low, and they're going to take 60%.
Yeah, so, I would not do that. Let me work with the CD baby situation, and then I'll also do some research about the other one.
That's fine. In the meanwhile, you know, Beverly can, we have the file, so if somebody wants to just buy it through Beverly, and she could email it, she could send it through an email once they pay for it, then they could have it, you know.
Okay.
So we'll see what
I can
do
set
with
us
that.
Up a place where they, I can think I can set up a secure link where if you have a code, you can download the files. In other words, if you bought, because the MP3 files right now where they are is not secure. If anybody finds out, they can just pick them up if they can get into it. You know, now it's on a Google Drive, and you've got to have the link, and you've got to have access to the link. But
right.
You know, once somebody's got MP3 files, that's what bothers me. Once you've got MP3 files, you can give them to anybody.
Right.
You know, whereas audiobook files, you know, there's usually you have to have an application that, it's just like CDs. You could used to not be able to, right. You know, copy CDs. You had to have the proper device or whatever to listen to them. Well, audio files that you get from like Audible and Amazon, stuff like that, they put a thing on the front end of it that if you're not coming through their application, you're not going to be able to hear it.
Right.
So anyway.
Okay. Anyway, it's just a thought.
And Karen, I'm still working on the research stuff. I promise you. My internet.
Well, just remember, send me a big dump of data. And you know, don't spend a lot of time analyzing it. That's what I'm good at.
Yes, you are.
And I love to do that. So.
Well, I promise that I will get it done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I forgot to stop the recording. Shoot.